Good afternoon, and welcome back to the 2006 series of Fireside Chats, broadcast live on www.sechistorical.org and archived in the Virtual Museum of SEC and Securities History. I'm Teresa Gabaldone, Professor of Law and Carville Dickinson Benson Research Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School and host of the chats this year. www.sechistorical.org is under the jurisdiction of the Securities and Exchange Commission Historical Society, a nonprofit organization separate from and independent of the SEC. The virtual museum and archive, free and available worldwide 24/7, offers a growing collection of primary materials and information on the impact that the SEC has had on national and international capital markets since its inception. The Society receives no federal funding. We are grateful for the sustained support of Pfizer, Inc., which is continuing its sponsorship of the Fireside Chat series in 2006. Today's Fireside Chat continues our exploration of some aspects of the critical role of the Internet in the capital markets. Our focus today is on EDGAR, the SEC's Electronic Data Gathering Analysis and Retrieval System. When EDGAR was launched in the early 1980s, electronic communication and online activity were in their infancy. The SEC not only had to grapple with the limitations of computers, but more importantly, had to satisfy the legal challenges of moving disclosure to an electronic world. Our panelists today are David Copenhafer of Bound & Company, Inc., and former SEC staff member, Amy Goodman of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, LLP, and former SEC staff member, and Jack Katz, former SEC secretary. All three of our panelists were there at the birth, in fact, before the birth, working on the initial development of EDGAR. The remarks made today are solely those of the speakers and are not representative of the Society. Our speakers cannot give investment or legal advice. David, Amy, and Jack, welcome. I'd like to start today with a little trip down memory lane. David, would you mind beginning with a brief reminiscence about the state of technology in the early 1980s when EDGAR was just a gleam in the eye of, I guess, Commissioner Shad?
It's, excuse me, it's hard to find the one word. I would say rudimentary in looking back, in looking at what was available in terms of PCs. The equipment at the time did not have hard drives. Screens were certainly in black and white. Communications were extraordinarily difficult. The time it took to even transmit a small filing to the SEC was something on the order of a minute a page.
It's been so easy to forget how far we've come in those 20-some years. Were people at that time using email or other electronic communication?
No, not really.
People didn't have computers on their desk. At the SEC, there were Lexitrons and Wangs, but no one of a professional nature would dream of having had a computer on their desk.
Email didn't exist.
No.
What were large companies doing then, both about keeping electronic corporate records and using technology to compare their disclosure documents?
I would say it was just beginning. I mean, that was a part of our initial investigation, was to get some sense of the extent to which companies made use of automated record-keeping systems or used typewriters of, I mean, I can't even think of the right word, but word processing equipment that allowed them to move information perhaps from the company to law firms or to the printer in an electronic format. Our first investigation showed that, in fact, it was happening on a larger scale than we thought perhaps it was.
But it was more the law firms preparing documents in electronic format. Companies, to the extent they were keeping electronic records, were keeping them on tapes. There was no such thing as servers and instant retrieval.
and there was no vehicle for transmission. Facsimile machines. Fax machines were in their infancy.
Right, 1980. Remember, we're talking about the period when we were exploring was 1983. Fax machines didn't really get ubiquitous till 85, 86.
Mm-hmm. And I remember the silver paper that they used to have. Amy, as best you recall, what was the sequence of events that led to the initial EDGAR program?
Well, back in about late 82, early 83, I was heading up the Office of Disclosure Policy, and the division director of Corp Fin at that time was Lee Spencer, and he was giving a speech and was interested in exploring the use of technology in connection with the disclosure process. And we prepared a speech called The Electric Library, this notion of SEC documents available in an electronic form. And it caught the chairman's fancy. Chairman Shad had been on Wall Street, and Jack will talk about it more, but there was a lot of frustration by people on the street getting a hold of documents at the SEC. And he and therefore got enamored of this idea of moving forward with technology and creating an electronic repository of SEC documents. And that's really what made this all possible was the commitment of the chairman, and more than the commitment, the push. He created a task force of which we were all representatives and people from investment management and other parts of the commission, and told us to do it, basically.
What were some of those frustrations, Jack?
Well, you have to understand, the timing of it was fascinating. John Shad had spent his career on Wall Street. He was head of investment banking at E.F. Hutton, which at that time I think was the number two firm on the street. And this was the modern bull market really began in 82. There was huge activity then on Wall Street. It was beginning the takeover craze. At that time, you found out whether a company was in play when somebody acquired stock and had to file what was called a 13D with the commission. That document was the first indication that a company was in play, and it was extraordinarily market sensitive. The problem was it was filed at the SEC, and it was filed with whichever exchange the company was listed on. And companies understood how the process worked, and if they wanted to delay the public's ability to see these things, they could game the system. In essence, you had to get the information from the SEC's public reference room in Washington. At the time, the New York Times did a feature article on the second largest zoo in Washington, is the title of it. It was the SEC's public reference room. This information had such commercial value that there were, at any time, between 15 and 20 private companies that kept staff on a full-time basis in the commission's public reference room. Each of these companies was allowed to pay for their own telephone line, and the commission had a contractor that did two things. They prepared microfiche copies of all filings, and they had the concession to operate Xerox machines, copiers, in the public reference room. On any given day, those copiers would generate 250,000 pages of copies of documents. Companies would be paid, literally, to scan a document and to call their clients by phone and say, Ivan Boesky just filed a D on XYZ company. This is how much he has. People would know, and people would immediately trade on the information. In fact, I mentioned Boesky because I subsequently learned that Boesky had more than one of the so-called service bureaus on his retainer. And what he would do is pay both of them for any filings they alerted him to, and he would give a bonus to whichever one called him first. He was not the only one. There were fights in the reference room. Documents were torn as people grabbed at them and fought over them.
It sounds like a real informational bottleneck.
Well, it was, and it moved the market. And if you think of an efficient market, this was the bottleneck, and this created huge informational advantages and disadvantages that the street could exploit. Shad knew about this. Shad had experienced this from the other side, and it was an enormous frustration for him that the commission was part of the problem.
Documents would also disappear from time to time, too, didn't they?
That's right. There was a constant problem with documents disappearing, and the problems were everyone you can imagine. In fact, in about 1984, I was responsible for having one of my employees criminally indicted for accepting gratuities from one of the service bureaus for getting the first view at hot filings before they were made available to the others.
And that's how valuable the information was.
It's that sort of environment.
So Shad created this task force made up of people throughout the commission and directed us to develop this quote-unquote electronic library, and we had to focus on three three pieces. First, getting the filings in the door electronically, then how the staff would use them. And I was in the Division of Corporation Finance, and that was a big part of my job, was figuring out how CorpFin would use them, as well as getting companies to agree to file them electronically. And then the other end, which we didn't get to, which really was saved by the Internet, was how would these filings then become available to the public.
Amy brings up one of the critical points here, and Dave can talk about this. When we were talking about the state of art and technology, there was no Internet. There was no commercial electronic system for transmitting information anywhere. And this project entailed 10,000 to 15,000 companies sending filings in electronically, but the vision of this project was that it was going to make information available to the public. There had to be what we refer to as the back end. There had to be an infrastructure that would enable tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people to access this in real time for it to, in fact, do what was intended. The technology didn't exist.
The notion was that the equivalent of the service bureaus who handled things in paper, that there would be companies who would buy access to the EDGAR information, so-called wholesalers, who would then make it available to the investing public.
That's right. And the other piece of this, remember, is, as you can see, the scope of this. This was a huge technology project. In addition to all the technological questions involved and the regulatory questions, there was a third component. How were we going to pay for it? The estimates at the time were that it was going to cost $30 million. In 1983, the SEC's entire budget was a little over $90 million. This would have essentially been a third of the commission's budget. And this was the first Reagan administration when there were huge pressures on government agencies to reduce the size of government and reduce spending. Going in for a 30% increase in the SEC's budget was just not a realistic possibility.
Let's break this down a little bit. Now, you mentioned the difficulty of getting the filings in the door, at any rate, that's the one end of the snake that you need to deal with. David, how did you coax
people into the system? We really didn't right away. We started with a pilot group of 250 companies, and in part that was a relatively small group and a manageable group and allowed everybody to experiment with the communications capabilities at the time. And frankly, I don't think there was any more difficult challenge up front than communication. What we typically are able to do today over the Internet, where you can send millions of bytes a second, we had companies that essentially had to connect to the EDGAR pilot and transmit at speeds that were perhaps 1,000 bytes a second. And documents came in so slowly, it was possible to put a device in the circuit and you could literally see line by line as the communications came into the SEC. So I think we were fortunate, as Jack said, that in some ways, while we were ahead of ourselves a bit, technology did evolve and allowed us, as time went on, to technology caught up to our needs.
But to get those 250 companies in the pilot, we had to go out on the, I went out on the stump circuit, and I felt like I was going to get rotten tomatoes thrown at me, because remember, companies had to do what was called EDGARizing their filing. They had to get their filing all ready for submission to the SEC, and then they had to make adjustments to the filing in terms of putting on certain headers and putting on other information so that it could be filed with the SEC. So there was some burden involved as well.
And Amy, wasn't there also a fear, since the potential of EDGAR was to improve the quality of analysis and review at the commission? This is not necessarily something desirable for issuers.
Might be too good.
Right. Rather remain at the bottom of the paper stack.
How much reluctance do you think reflected the fact that people weren't all that enthusiastic about the commission having the ability to do automated analysis?
I guess, but remember, the commission was to some limited extent doing some automated analysis. The commission was, CorpFin was, even back at that time, there was an outfit, I think it was called CompuStat, that was selling tapes of analysis that the commission was buying and using in its process. So I don't think there was too much of a fear of better analysis by the commission, but more a fear of the unknown, and there is still tremendous liability attached to SEC filings. Mm-hmm. So there was some reluctance. I remember we had to do an especially active sales job among the lawyers, who tended to be much more conservative and not want their clients involved in this project.
Again, to give you an idea, though, the CompuStat service that he was referring to, my recollection of it was that CompuStat's database was always at least one quarter and sometimes two quarters behind, because they had to extract data from paper filings and literally send it out to be keystroked in. And they had to do a quality check of
right.
it. So it was anywhere from 3 to 6 months behind the time, by the time it was available.
So it sounds as though it really was contemplated that the SEC would be doing something different in their review process, given the electronic documents that were being filed, that is, themselves, as opposed to receiving it from CompuStat?
Well, I think initially the intent was that the SEC staffers would get the filings and have them available more freely and be able to, for example, if you're reviewing a registration statement and you also want to review other filings of the company, CorpFin staff had to order the filings. You know, they had to order the 10-Ks or the 10-Qs and wait for a day or two for them to be delivered from the bowels of the commission.
In microfiche.
Right. In microfiche. Right. I mean, the part of the beauty of EDGAR to CorpFin was that all the filings would be available to them, and in addition, on the same computer screens, they would have access to word processing to write comment letters and access to
legal research.
To legal research and electronic databases. The funny thing about all this was when we were first starting to work on the functionality of the system and representing CorpFin, and I didn't have a computer background at all. I knew nothing about technology. And when I said we have to be able to do multiple things on the screen at the same time, we were told by the consultants from MITRE who had been hired to help us with the system, well, you can't do that. And thankfully, 6 months later, Windows came along.
But, Amy, and a good point about this, remember, this was just a couple of years really after integrated disclosure took effect. Integrated disclosure was incorporation by reference to other documents. If you were reviewing a registration statement, you'd have to go root around to find that 10-K somewhere.
Excellent point.
Remember the debate about what should the format of the documents be, too. I mean, there was a great desire to make it easy and rely on the word-processed version, and yet we all knew what the problems were when a new version of Word came along, or Word Perfect came along. Those without the new version couldn't read the old documents, and the decision to
And what about graphs and pictures? And
right, very tough one.
Right.
Do you want to explain the?
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the other thing we had to do, and this is back when there were multitudes of word processors available. It wasn't just like everybody was using Word or Word Perfect. There were 15 or 20 very popular word processors, and we were the government, and we couldn't be in a position of telling people which word processor they had to use. So we had to set up a system that would receive filings in all of these different denominators.
And just to give an example, there were just a plethora of word processing packages out there. WordPerfect hadn't been invented, and neither had Word.
And we also had to be able to receive diskettes and tapes because of, as Dave mentioned, the speed was so slow that some people couldn't get used to the idea of submitting these documents with all this legal liability through the air. So they felt much more comfortable hand-delivering a disk or a tape to the SEC.
And plus the transmission problem, right, you could have a line drop in the middle of a document.
And then you'd have to start from scratch.
It also reminds me of one of the things we didn't realize in the pilot was that those sitting on the filing end, the moment they hit the key to send, they wanted to know, was it there? Did you get it? And the phones rang off the hook.
Right.
And we had no easy way of responding to the filer to let them know that the document came through in its entirety, that we had it, what we were going to do with it, and led to...
And the other problem was, I just want to mention this because I think it's important, that there was a disconnect between the paper document and the electronic document because the technology wouldn't allow people to submit charts and graphs and photos and things like that.
Right.
So we had to adopt rules that dealt with the graphics and the pictures and to prescribe what had to be in which. And we also, Chairman Shad made, I think, was a very good decision that the official filing had to be the electronic filing. Because if we didn't do that, nobody would take
Absolutely.
The electronic filing seriously.
Absolutely.
And that was a very important decision. It was fought hard by people both inside the commission and people on the outside. But I think in retrospect, if we hadn't, it never would have happened.
I mean, it put tremendous pressure on everybody to get it right. The incentives were so strong that it really had to be done properly.
And you know, Amy's point about Chairman Shad, I don't think people appreciate that Edgar, I don't believe, would have happened in the time period or in the way it did without John Shad forcing people to make tough decisions that they were, frankly, not always comfortable making.
I mean, we had to write the rules, Regulation ST, which has changed over the years, but that was basically a regulation that adjusted all of the commission's rules dealing with the submission of paper documents to deal with the electronic. So that had to be written in a weekend so that the pilot could get started and people could start filing.
At every step in the way, John Shad set what we thought were unrealistic demands and completion dates that we didn't think we could accomplish, but we had no choice because he was adamant. When we began just the process of identifying a contractor to develop this, he basically said, I want this thing up and running in, what, 18 months?
Right.
And this is the pilot. This is the pilot.
This can't do this. We're going to take 3 or 4 or 5 years. He says, fine, you've got 18 months.
We did it. We did it.
Well, were there any disasters along the way or near disasters?
You know, fortunately, no. And, in fact, I think when we all look back, if there had been a real disaster early in the process, that would have been the end of it.
Well, I don't know. There was that plane flight we took from Philadelphia to Harrisburg. We, in connection with the – now, remember, the other thing that I didn't recognize, I was a securities lawyer. I was in Court Finn, was we were working under the government. We had all these federal procurement regulations to deal with, which are very cumbersome and complicated, and we were trying to do a – pilot. So we had to do a formal request for proposal for the pilot, and we were only worried that no one would respond, but the three companies did respond.
Or three groups.
Three groups, right. And so we had to travel around and look at the technology and make sure, you know, to help us evaluate which ones to select. And as part of that process, we ended up on a flight from
Philadelphia
to Harrisburg. There was a 12-person plane, and the stewardess took out her Bible, so we were really in trouble.
It was when they said the Muzak, I realized it was playing Nearer My God to Thee. We flew from Washington to Chicago to make one visit, and then we had to then fly to our next visit for one of the other bidders from Chicago to Philadelphia and connect from Philadelphia to Harrisburg. And it was a raging electrical storm. It was just a very ugly evening. And we got on this little puddle jumper, like 12 seats. We've got the entire plane. And we're flying just about an hour. And enormous rainstorm.
I mean,
and the plane
got blown off the runway.
And at one point I said to the stewardess, how high do the headwinds have to be for us not to be able to fly? She says, oh, probably 40 or 50 miles per hour. And I says, oh, what do you think it is out there now? She says, oh, maybe 35 max.
We got to Harrisburg. And the other thing is we got to see some technology way before we thought it existed. I'll never forget when we were in Harrisburg at one of the bidders. They showed us how the New York Times Magazine section, the photographs, were doctored. Now, they didn't use the word doctored, but they showed us they were digitized, and they were trying to show us there how great their technology was, and they were showing us how they changed photograph. Well, back then, everybody thought you saw a photograph, and that's what it
And one of our fears, of course, with this whole project was the integrity of the document.
Right.
There was a serious concern that people could doctor documents after they had been filed and manipulate them. So when we saw this, we were horrified.
Imagine if you could change, once a financial statement's been filed, if someone could hack into the system and change the numbers. I mean, that was a tremendous fear.
That, in fact, was one of my questions. I take it that either doesn't or can't happen. Is that correct?
I mean, security is a huge concern, and it's obviously gotten a lot stronger over the years, but it did not happen. Mm-hmm. Back to your question about disasters, though, there was one minor disaster. Amy mentioned the fact that an awful lot of information came in on diskette, and the diskette allowed filers to send us their information in their original word processed version. We had a device that read the word processed version and then converted it to ASCII. It was actually the Antares. And the Antares was a good machine, but it wasn't infallible. And there was a company that projected earnings would be 3-4% in an upcoming year. The Antares ate the dash, and growth was suddenly 34% in the next year. That didn't sink the pilot, obviously, but it was as close as we wanted to come to a disaster.
Yeah, let me just mention something, because I think it's worth mentioning. You know, people complain about Edgar, like they complain about everything else. The pilot began in 85. It's now 2005. During that time, hackers have never taken Edgar down.
No. That's true.
That's 20 true. Years. That's a remarkable statement.
We don't want to encourage you. It's not a challenge.
No, but you think they've tried.
I can assure you many, many times. Right. There is a full-time staff at the SEC devoted just to security.
Well, I'm sure that's one of the many things that made Edgar expensive in the first place and keeps it expensive. And I'm interested in returning to the point that you made earlier about how was this thing going to be paid for and what role were user fees going to play in all that?
Well, that, it's funny. You talk about things that could have been disasters. The funding issue probably came as close as anything to sinking the project. The commission, as I had mentioned, had a contractor that microfiched all documents and then had a concession to operate the copying machines in the public reference rooms. As you can imagine, that was a very lucrative contract. And the commission over the years had essentially negotiated the equivalent of a barter contract with the company, where the commission was receiving its microfiche copies for free. And this company then was essentially had the right to sell those commercially to the public and to operate this monopoly in the public reference room at rates that the commission regulated. It was a very lucrative contract, but it was in everybody's best interest. And our original thought was we were not going to get an appropriation from Congress, so we would adopt the same model. We would make this essentially a self-funded contract where, as part of the bidding process for the operational contract, not the pilot contract,
the pilot was paid for. There was money for the pilot.
We would, in fact, give the company the same sort of concession to sell this data commercially at regulated prices. And there are two advantages to this. The first one is the notion of self-funding, that this was the only way it was going to ever happen. And the second one was there was no internet. There was no back end out there. So in essence, whoever this contractor was, in order to benefit from this, they were going to have to build that distribution network. And our thought was the private sector was going to be much better equipped to develop a robust commercial distribution system than the government could ever do. So we thought we were killing two birds with one stone.
But it was tremendously controversial. Congressman Dingell, for example, who was not fond of some of Chairman Shadd's other initiatives as chairman, took issue with the self-funding and with what was going on with Edgar, and there were some acrimonious congressional hearings that actually made the national news over Chairman Dingell's unhappiness with the Edgar system.
And the SEC.
Yeah, and his view was twofold. I mean, the underlying agenda, there really was. There was an enormous sort of problem between John Dingell and Congress and John Shadd. They just It wasn't a personal animus. They just had broad philosophical disagreements. And Dingell looked at what we were describing, and he identified three problems with it. The first one was, if we were doing this outside the budget process, we were essentially eliminating Congress's right to control agency appropriations, so-called augmentation of government appropriation. His second concern was philosophical. These were documents filed with the government in the public domain, and he distrusted the notion that, in fact, we were giving a private license to someone to commercially market, even at regulated rates, documents that were in the public domain. And then the third problem that John Dingell had was to do with the pivotal player in the development contract that he had great concerns about.
Right, and the pilot, of course, it was Arthur Andersen, and he also had a great mistrust of even the auditing and accounting industry.
This was a point when concerns about auditor independence were being raised that came into the forefront much more recently. But this was when accounting firms were just starting to get into the consulting business, so there was some concern about that as well.
And also there was a concern that he expressed that to the extent that Andersen learned too much about the inner workings of the SEC, this could in some way leak back to the auditing profession, somehow provide them with some sort of unfair advantage. Mm-hmm. And these were really fundamental concerns. And John Dingell started a series of hearings on the future of EDGAR that actually delayed the development of the operational contract by, what, 2 full years?
Oh, easily more than that.
This seems like a good time to pose a question that was submitted by one of our listeners, Chris Nape of the Grand Rapids Press. Why must the public turn to for-profit private services to perform a basic function in EDGAR like a full-text search?
I mean, that really is a good question, and it comes right out of this whole discussion of who's going to pay for it and funding. And in fact, the resolution of the debate that Jack described was that of EDGAR's three subsystems, the front end, receipt and acceptance, the SEC's internal system, those two would be paid for with appropriated funds. The dissemination subsystem was paid for and is still paid for with private money. The contractor builds
SEC.gov.
That's right.
Right. The basic, with the notion being that the public should have access to the EDGAR filings, and they do have access to the basic EDGAR filings through the SEC website.
But it created the basic structure where the SEC's interest, particularly in the earliest years and before the internet was started, our interest was to create and strengthen a commercial side to document distribution. Those days are gone, but there's still, in some ways, a public policy debate about what's appropriate use of federal funds and what's appropriate to have the private sector finance.
And let me actually answer his question. And as you know, I retired from the commission on January 4th. And at the time of my retirement, the SEC.gov website was under my responsibility. And I agreed with the question that there should be full-text search capability on there. And I will tell you that one of my goals was to have that done before I retired in January. It didn't happen. And at the risk of disclosing non-public information, but I think it's for a good purpose, the commission is actively working on this. And I have every expectation that in the near future there will be free full-text searching of EDGAR documents.
That's probably the answer to his follow-up question as well, then. Are there plans to make the public's access to the EDGAR database more flexible?
And the answer is, yeah. We can talk a bit, if you want, about the NYU contract. As we said, our original model in the 80s predated the Internet. There was no way the government could ever develop a fully functioning dissemination system just because the technology didn't exist. The Internet changed that. And with the development of the Internet, there was a strong push to, piggybacking on John Dingell's concerns, make this public domain information freely available. And one of the people who essentially got behind this very early was a guy by the name of Nader, who's been active in Washington for a number of years.
I've heard that name.
Dave, you want to talk about that?
Well, it was, in some respects, it created substantial problems for us because we did have a contract in this case, with LexisNexis, that they would be the sole provider of EDGAR information. A group was essentially successful in buying a copy of EDGAR information from LexisNexis and then through New York University, putting it up on the internet, although not in a web-based manner, but making it available for free on the internet. And so it created this tension between those who were looking to make the information available freely to the public and the need, our felt need to.
And this was what, about 92 or 93?
Yeah, I think that's about right.
And the timing of that is basically the SEC started its website in 95. And one of the real catalysts for that was essentially a recognition that the commission had to take over this responsibility from NYU, and the commission had to start providing that. And when SEC.gov was created, in the fall of 95, it began providing free EDGAR access. Right. Interestingly, on a 24-hour delay.
Right. That was because you had the contract that and you still needed to provide a financial incentive to the provider of immediate access.
Well, it was still important at that time to provide some reason for the commercial side to buy the data and build the services that today are quite useful.
And the 24-hour delay essentially faded away, in recollection is late 2001, early 2002. And it was when Harvey Pitt became chairman, and he had a meeting that I was in one morning said, "This is absurd. Get rid of it."
And the rest is history.
And the rest is history.
Well, speaking from history, I do have in my hot hand here a copy of a brochure that has been contributed to the SEC Historical Society. And I guess it was used back in 1985 or so to enlist the volunteers. And it seems to me that each of your pictures is in it and some of your names as well. So certainly we do have documentation that you were there at the time.
And we look exactly as we did in 1985.
I was going to say that very thing. I'm wondering, does anyone here remember who's responsible for naming the baby?
Who picks it? I was wondering if you were going to ask.
Yes, this is a great story. Chairman Shad offered a
$100
savings bond because he wanted something catchy, but it had to stand for something. So he offered, and the government couldn't provide the money, so out of his pocket he offered a $100 savings bond to whoever could come up with the catchiest name. And if I recall, Dan Gelzer, who was general counsel at the time, submitted about 10 different entries. But the winner actually was someone who was working on the EDGAR project, which was a little embarrassing, who is still with the commission, Herb Scholl, who's in the Division of Corporation Finance. And it stands for Electronic Data Gathering, Analysis, and Retrieval System. And this becomes very important because at one of these congressional hearings, when they asked Chairman Shad what it stood for, he said electronic data
gathering
and retrieval. And he didn't mention the analysis, and was given a hard time.
He was ready to check the A out.
Yes. And then I think it was at that point, as you may notice, when you look at old commission documents, EDGAR goes from being all capitalized to being non-capitalized, and it was in connection with that.
CBS Evening News showed that, and he was not happy about it. The other piece during that hearing was extraordinarily acrimonious. Some of us thought we were going to be fired at the end.
I actually had to testify at that hearing, and the only thing that kept Dingell, I think, from giving me a hard time was I was about 8 months pregnant.
One of the other congressmen took the name EDGAR and started talking about all the things that it didn't do. And he would very showy take out the letters and pull out a letter and until he had only Ed left. And then he said, and the reason we're left with Ed is because the SEC is essentially trying to build the equivalent of a talking horse. They should just call it Mr. Ed. It was
catchy, but
it was catchy, and it was just a. But it revealed basically the daring of the project, because he was absolutely right. In 1984, the technology didn't exist to make this happen. That's what made it so extraordinary.
I read that you even needed to figure out how to deal with things like electronic signatures, for instance.
Right, and that's where Dan Gelzer was a big help as general counsel. We came up with this concept of PIN numbers, which, you know, are used today, but it was the notion that directors and officers would have PIN numbers. Thankfully, a few years into the pilot, we figured out we could get rid of them. But at the time, if it hadn't been for that, we couldn't have moved forward because, as we mentioned, there's tremendous legal liability that attaches to these
documents. And there's a requirement that people sign the documents. By the way, in terms of the name, and Amy, there were some very funny suggestions. One of my favorites was, in fact, I think Dan submitted it, recommended naming it JAWS. Because he said it was about to swallow the commission's budget.
I can see why that one didn't win. Generally, how would you say the Edgar of today is different than the Edgar of the mid-1980s?
It's grown in terms of the number of form types that it would handle, even though almost all of the basic 33 and 34 Act forms were part of the operational system. There's been a gradual movement to move some of the less well-known forms. I think threes, fours, and fives, so-called ownership documents, were not part of EDGAR for a long time.
Why is that?
Well, the big reason is because they're primarily submitted by individuals. Threes, fours, and fives are ownership reports, and the commission felt that the burden of having each individual officer and director be responsible for possibly preparing an electronic document.
And also private shareholders who weren't necessarily affiliated with
it. 10% shareholders.
Right, though over time people came to realize that many, in fact at most companies, the corporate secretary or somebody at the company helps officers and directors do it. But it was also the notion that EDGAR is free form text, while forms 3, 4s, and 5s are structured documents. And so I think there was an interest in creating a easier way for people to file based on the structured nature of the document.
But it was also the sheer number. There are hundreds of thousands of ownership reports.
270,000 each year.
Yeah. It's a huge number. And remember, some proportion of those are filed by individuals. And when EDGAR began, this notion of the PIN, you would have had to have given each of these individuals a PIN number. You would have had to maintain it. And you also had a transmission problem. Pre-internet, people didn't have necessarily transmission capability in their home or their office.
And the ability of the system to handle volumes is still staggering. I mean, on a day like the 10K peak, during the pilot, we were lucky if we saw a filing or two a day. EDGAR has had peak days of 9,000-10,000 documents. Filing sizes of several hundred pages. The volume of information that flows into the SEC seamlessly electronically today is really staggering when you look back at the beginning.
Right, and Dave, let me just mention, pre-EDGAR, on 10K day, when basically 7,000 companies had to file their 10Ks and had to file, what was it, 6 copies, as I recall. On that day, here was the process. About 10 to 20 of the largest trucks FedEx had would be lined up, double parked, outside the SEC headquarters, wheeling millions of pages of documents in. Basically, every available clerical employee of the commission would have to pitch in, and the entire lower floor of the agency, including its commission meeting room, would have tables set up. And people will be standing there, literally
stamping
each of the 6 copies and throwing them into bins. One bin to go out to be microfiched, one bin to go to the public reference room. Millions of pages coming in manually like that. It was just overwhelming. It would literally take a week just to finish the processing of this information.
And there was a lot of pressure when we were doing the pilot to think about revamping the system, for example, changing the dates so that not everybody had to file at the same time because were building for peak periods and all. But the decision was made and Chad stood by it that we were already doing something revolutionary back then with creating an electronic system, and that if we tried to also change the filings or the dates or other things at the same time, it would have just been too much.
One revolution at a time,
mm-hmm,
please.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The brochure mentions that you hoped to eliminate most of the 5 million pieces of paper filed each year. It sounds like Edgar made a lot of progress on that front. Do you think the SEC has gone virtually paperless? Does it have much smaller file rooms now?
I mean, certainly for document storage and retrieval, the answer is yes. I think, and Amy and Jack can talk about this, but even within the agency, examiners are no different than the rest of us. Reading a very long document on screen is a difficult process, and people, one way or another, are going to print out the material that they have to look at.
Electronics is a great way to transmit and to store information. It's a lousy way to sit at a terminal and read long documents. And in fact, the goal when the project began was that it was going to be paperless, that people were going to sit there at terminals. And what happened was what human nature would suggest. People would immediately print out documents, except people didn't have their own printers. They would have to send a request, and there was one mammoth laser printer that would print them. And the printing costs were breaking the contract budget, do you recall?
Well, and in fact, printing turns out not to be technologically very easy also. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's as big a challenge as almost anything.
And what we discovered was, very early on, examiners who were having a hard time getting the printed copy done and were going crazy, their eyes were going bad, staring at the screen, were making phone calls and saying, can you meet me down in the lobby and drop me off a copy?
Yeah, well, this was with the filers with the law firms, right?
So you have this gray market and three copies being developed.
And you were hoping that they were the same thing as the one. David, this one's definitely for you. The word printing was mentioned. How has the role of the financial printer changed?
In many respects, not a lot. I think that when we were first starting the process of understanding the flow of documents and information, we did find that printers sort of stood between issuers and their counsel and the SEC. And in fact, I think we came to look at the industry as a bit of a safety valve. That Amy talked about Edgarization, the challenge of getting a word process document into the form and format that the SEC wanted to receive. That was something that printers knew how to do. And so I think we felt confident that if issuers had a tough time doing it, they could always go to the printers. Printers, some in the early days, looked at Edgar and thought, this is going to put us out of business. I think the opposite happened, that it just became another service that was simply added to the normal process of preparing documents for print distribution to shareholders.
Have other countries done similar things?
Yes. Just about every country has something like this. There is the equivalent of Edgar in most countries in Europe. Canada has an excellent one. I've been to Mexico. They have their equivalent.
They did it much later.
But basically, in many respects, Edgar was the catalyst that caused other companies to do the same thing.
Are there state equivalents as well?
Right. Well, that was an interesting part of the early Edgar days, and the pilot was trying to get the states involved as well to figure out a way to make the filings available at the state level as well, because we thought that would be an incentive to the issuer community.
And the law was different at that time.
Right.
Now, by and large, companies that are listed no longer have to make
state filings.
There's still an issue on the mutual fund
side, particularly
for so-called blue sky
state. Because it's the way the exemption reads, it's companies listed on NASDAQ, listed on exchanges.
Right.
So that doesn't help mutual funds. Companies had to make filings in states that they were going to offer in. This was a tremendous burden and expense to issuers if they were going to do a national offering to get one of these things filed and effective in every state. So that we thought one of the real incentives to volunteering was one-stop shopping, that filing on Edgar would, in fact, take care of your state responsibilities.
But it got very complicated because the states are 50 states, and we were working with their association, but there were different interests and different questions about how it would all get get paid for. It ultimately worked itself out, but it took far longer than I think people anticipated.
Comparing the brochure to what seems to be the state of the art today, it seems like you all were terrific prognosticators in the 1980s. So I'm going to give you a little test now, and we'll come back in 10 years and see how correct you were this time. But I'd like to do an update on what it is you see coming down the pike as far as new developments in EDGAR and electronic disclosure. I've heard specifically something about a voluntary extensible business reporting language program. What is that all about?
Well, XBRL is a way. Remember, we mentioned early on everyone was searching for a way to extract the financial information out of filings, with the notion being EDGAR is basically text, but people want to do financial ratios and all kinds of analysis. In order to be able to do that, you've got to pick numbers out of the financial statement. And while there are certain terms like net income that everybody uses, there are a lot of terms in financial statements that vary among companies and among industries, so it's not that easy to do. This was something that we identified early on in the pilot as something we wanted the system to be able to do, and we explored all kinds of ways to do it. One of the more interesting was we went out to Arthur Andersen's artificial intelligence lab in Chicago to determine whether we could use artificial intelligence concepts to have the computer read the financial statements and pick the number off. At that time, they were using artificial intelligence a lot in the oil and gas area to help them figure out where to explore, where to look for oil. But we determined that financial statements were too complicated, and we couldn't do that. So we came up with something called a financial data schedule, an FDS, in which companies filing on EDGAR with filings that had financial statements in them, primarily 10-Ks and 10-Qs, companies would have to fill out something called a financial data schedule. And we picked out, what was it, about 25 items off of the...
All from Reg SX.
Right? We picked out 20 or 25 items that had to be listed on this schedule, and companies would have to take the numbers from their financial statements and put them in this schedule. It was not...
Template.
It was a template. And this was not considered part of the official filing, so that got people comfortable so that the auditors wouldn't have to sign off on it. And the idea was that the staff would then use these financial data schedules to pick out numbers and run ratios, but unfortunately people didn't it wasn't a file document and people didn't give it the attention that it deserved, so it ultimately was determined that the results were not very usable, and ultimately the commission abandoned that. What XBRL is a computer language that's designed to do the same thing, to tag, basically, items in the financial statements. And Dave can talk more than I can to the technology. But the idea here is, once again, to be able to pick numbers out of the financial statements so that investors and analysts and other people can do analysis. And XBRL has been around for a while, and the commission staff has been working on it, but with new Chairman Cox arriving, he's very interested in technology and the use of XBRL and has pushed the commission to explore this far more seriously, and they are in the midst of a pilot project, and I think just last week or the week before they announced that 17 additional companies had participated, and it reminded all of us very much of Chairman Shadd's interest in EDGAR as what made it possible. And I think given the tremendous interest of Chairman Cox in XBRL, I think this is something that will undoubtedly move forward.
I mean, you've done a good job in explaining it. In many ways, the analog is back to the financial data schedule, but the instead of 20-some items being tagged, XBRL allows for tagging with great accuracy, hundreds of different line items extracted and tagged from the financial statement. Some people have likened it to putting a barcode on every number in the statement. So not only do you know which line item it comes from and you know what period of reporting is involved, there's the capability to identify which circular or bulletin the accounting judgment was drawn from. There's the ability to assign to the line item foreign language translations. There's other abilities to provide information on how a particular number can and should be used in certain calculations. So it's a very comprehensive technology, very powerful, but as you can see, also very complex.
And it also raises a lot of the same problems that Edgar raises, because companies' financial statements, especially among industries, are different. And so this requires companies to either standardize, which I think they're reluctant to do, or what XBRL does is it allows companies through additional programming to extend XBRL. That's, you sometimes hear about the extendable.
Make up your own tags,
which is fine, so companies have the flexibility, but there is a cost and effort involved in creating those tags.
And a concern that if you extend the basic tag set, can you be assured that that information is comparable and gets analyzed in the right way.
And yeah. Then, well, your accountants, I mean, then you've got to worry about the role of the accountants here, because if in fact it's the tag data that's going to be used for the analysis and investment decisions, both the company and their outside auditors are going to want to make sure that that's accurate.
Yeah, and just a cautionary note. I mean, this is clearly the direction the commission has to go, but a commissioner who I've often thought was possibly the finest securities lawyer on the commission during my tenure there once made the comment to me that whenever he looked at a commission document, first he read all the footnotes and then he read the text, because the interesting information is always in the footnotes. The same, unfortunately or fortunately, is true for financial statements. The footnotes are critical to understanding it, and the footnotes are where the meat often is.
And where XBRL gets toughest.
And that's the problem. There is, unfortunately, a perception that all financial statements are created equal. They're not. There is huge difference, legitimate differences, between companies and between industries. And the footnotes are where you capture those distinctions that oftentimes are absolutely essential to understanding the financial statement. That's the challenge of XBRL. How do you accommodate those legitimate inconsistencies in a way that still enables the sort of automated, uniform analysis across companies and industries? It's right. A very big challenge.
And technology has come a long way, and there are some systems that will try to automate the process of converting financial statements into XBRL, but given the inaccuracies and the importance of the numbers, they're not perfect, and so how you get and that the effort involved in verifying the numbers that are going to be submitted on XBRL will be an interesting question. I think this new pilot that the commission has established will show over the next year or so how doable this is.
And if I could add just one point to that, Amy made something that's a really critical point. The original development of EDGAR, the notion was that we were going to create an electronic parallel to the paper filing. That was a conscious decision because there were limitations. There were concerns. What XBRL is pointing you in the direction of is maybe it's now time for the commission not to create electronic parallels to paper filings, but rethink EDGAR in terms of an electronic filing that takes full advantage of an electronic filing and isn't bound by the limitations of paper.
For example,
a new paradigm.
Right. But for example, today there are all kinds of exhibits to filings, 10-Ks and 10-Qs, that are very difficult to find. All that could be in an electronic file.
Well, I think our time is up. Amy, David, and Jack, thank you so much for the fascinating examination of the roots and branches of EDGAR. As the SEC further develops its online filing functions, it's a very good thing to understand where we came from and how the process began. I would like to remind our audience that this fireside chat is now archived by audio tape at www.sechistorical.org. The transcript of the chat will be ready soon. The fireside chats will resume this summer when we bring back the best of NERA in late July. Please check www.sechistorical.org later this spring for our broadcast date and time. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
Thank you.